This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Tuesday, April the 25th. I'm Angela Denning. A bill for a land swap between the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and the U.S. Forest Service is making its way through the state legislature. The bill would transfer 18,000 acres of mental health trust land to the federal government in exchange for about 20,000 acres of the Tongass National Forest near Ketchikan and on Prince of Wales Island. The trust lands that would be exchanged are near Petersburg, Ketchikan, Juneau, Wrangell, Sitka, Myers Chuck, and on Kiu Island. The Mental Health Trust wants to log their lands to make money for the trust. Plans to log the parcels near some of the communities have sparked opposition, prompting the proposed exchange. The bill has already passed the Alaska Senate and has had hearings on the House side. One version of the bill had a hearing in the House Finance Committee this month. Republican Senator Bert Stedman is the bill's sponsor. He explained the legislation to that committee.
The concerns that some of the communities brought forward to deal with this conflict of if we were going to go in and have mental health harvest a substantial amount of volume right behind some of the communities is how to mitigate that impact and frankly swap it out to some other property.
The exchange has support from the timber industry in Alaska and Washington State, along with Southeast Conference and some communities and businesses in the region. Craig Mayor Dennis Watson testified in support of the exchange.
The bill and the timber supply it will create are extremely important to Prince of Wales Island and to the city of Craig. It will keep the island's timber industry and our economy going, while efforts to lift restrictions on federal timber sales are allowed to bear fruit. This timber supply will also keep our largest sawmill, Viking Lumber, in operation.
The exchange has opposition from several environmental groups and individuals in Southeast. Larry Edwards of Sitka testified in support of a buyout of the mental health land instead of a swap. His reason? Logging impacts on Prince of Wales Island and near Ketchikan.
There's been no consideration at all for the impacts that would happen for this kind of logging on this scale in those places. Fish and Game was not invited to testify. I think that the legislature has an obligation to look at what the impacts will be for that side of this proposed exchange, and that a buyout would be a far better solution.
The bill was moved out of the House Finance Committee and has another hearing in front of the House Rules Committee on April 26th at 1:30 p.m. Federal legislation to enact the exchange is also before Congress this year. About 90 high schoolers from around Southeast Alaska spent 4 days here in Petersburg making art. The regional art festival known as Art Fest came to a close on Sunday night with a show in the gym. Art Fest culminates in this, the Public Art Expo. Colorful art is everywhere, on the walls, on tables. There are sculptures, copper jewelry, leather masks, and carved wooden spoons. At a nearby table, people thumb through the pages of visual journals. Some of the journals feature homemade carved stamps. It's all work students have created over the last 4 days while taking courses from several local and regional artists. Each class was intensive, lasting 15 hours. Students chose 2 courses for 30 hours of instruction.
It's very rigorous.
Ann Litkemeyer is one of the instructors. She's the middle and high school art teacher in Wrangell. She led a course on making paper sculpture light boxes. It's layers and layers of paper cutouts that are backlit inside a shadow box.
They came out beautifully. A lot of cutting and X-Acto knives, so it's a lot of detailed work. I didn't have any student that complained about the work. They were really focused, really engaged in it.
The long hours at the festival didn't bother 17-year-old Zach Breen of Skagway. He chose a workshop on painting longboards using formline, the design and indigenous art of the Tlingit. He says it was difficult getting the design down.
There's certain ways to do it. Like you start with a shape called an ovoid, and then you kind of work off of that shape to create different animals.
Another course was taught by instructor Angela Imboden from Juneau. She's participated in Art Fest before. This year, she was teaching a class called Parallel Pen Wizardry. It's creating designs through calligraphy but with special pens.
And so we can do a lot of different types of strokes, and that's what the kids learned how to do, and then they put it together with calligraphy, letters, and then with tattoo designs.
What did you think about the students that were here at Art Fest, the ones that you taught this year?
I want to take them all home with me. They were so fun. They're so enthusiastic. They came, some of them have never done calligraphy, and it was a little frustrating at first for some of them to get the thick, thin, and the hang of how to hold the pen and how to do the different strokes, but they stuck with it, and they did beautiful work.
Part of Art Fest is celebrating the students' achievements through awards. Students cheer from the bleachers as some of them are called out for honorable mentions and best of shows. There are over a dozen categories. Receiving one of the top honors is senior Jacqueline Benham. She wins best of show for the whole festival for a jellyfish she painted using acrylics. It's a bright reddish-orange creature that pops out from a sea of pale aqua.
Its original photo looked like fire, like its spirit was like fire.
Benham is from the village of Cake, with about 600 residents. She has never been to Art Fest before. Cake doesn't have an art program, so Benham's history with art has mainly been sketching on her own.
It was a really great experience coming here and getting to meet everybody, and coming from Cake and not having an art program, it was a pretty great thing to get to express myself in ways that you don't really express yourself back at home.
She decided to go with the painting class because it was a practical art form she could share later on.
It seemed like something I could really actually take back home and like bring back to them and show them that it is possible to learn how to get into like painting and stuff, and it doesn't require like very much as opposed to like jewelry or carving. It could be really self-taught.
And it's not limiting. She's learned that there are many different ways you can pursue painting, which she's eager to try out in the future. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning. And Art Fest happens in Southeast every spring, hosted by different communities every year. To see photos from the expo, you can go to our website, kfsk.org, or visit us on Facebook. I will be posting them shortly. Juneau police say they located two 13-year-old boys that are believed to be involved in a fire that destroyed the playground at Twin Lakes. That was Monday evening. In a short statement today, Sergeant Chris Gifford says the boys were interviewed and then lodged at the Johnson Youth Center. The boys, who were not identified by name because they are juveniles, are being charged with felony arson in the second degree and felony criminal mischief in the first degree. There was at least an estimated $250,000 worth of damage to the playground after the fire started Monday evening, just before 6 o'clock. Juneau firefighters say it took 45 minutes to put out the fire. The spongy, rubber-chipped ground cover and the wood and recycled materials that formed the structures billowed black smoke into the air as it burned. It took an additional 2 hours to completely extinguish any remaining smoldering fire at the playground. No one was reported as injured. Fire marshals investigated the fire as potential arson. Ketchikan hosted the annual Alaska Wood Energy Conference last week, where participants heard about how biomass works in different places and how to make the technology more known and eventually less expensive to install and operate. KRBD's Layla Kara attended some of the sessions and has this report on how policy can shape the future of the biomass industry.
Biomass is ancient. Humans have been burning wood to produce heat and light for thousands of years, but new technology has turned that ancient energy source into low-emission fuel that fits nicely on the menu of renewable energy options. But unlike wind and solar, for example, biomass doesn't get a lot of policy perks, which has slowed its growth. That was a recurring theme of the 2017 Wood Energy Conference, Building Policy. In his presentation, Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project spent some time making the case for biomass. Energy demand is on the rise, fossil fuels will run out, and renewable energy is a fast-growing industry that the United States and Alaska shouldn't miss out on. One big reason is the potential cost savings.
Alaskans are estimated to be using about $5 billion worth of energy every year. So if you collectively put together all the money that you and I put into transportation, heat and electricity, 730,000 people, we're spending $5 billion. Well, let's just say we can save 20% of that $5 billion. That's $1 billion we're literally burning up every year. Literally burning up.
In Alaska, though, Rose says state funding for biomass has dried up, and traditional banks don't like to invest in biomass because they consider the technology too new and therefore risky. So what can be done? Rose suggests that the state establish a green bank. That's an independent state agency, kind of like the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, that attracts private investors for biomass projects by providing some guarantees for the loans.
It's all about not spending state money. It's all about leveraging state money and getting as much private money out of the markets as possible.
The model already exists, and Rose pointed to the Connecticut Green Bank as a success story. Canada already has taken a lead on encouraging biomass through policy. Several presenters from Canada talked about how that works for Alaska's closest neighbor. Fernando Prieto is a biomass researcher based out of British Columbia. He says the Canadian federal government has specific policies in its proposed budget to support renewable and sustainable energy projects, including biomass, for the Northern Territories. The total for those projects is about $300 million Canadian. That huge swath of land is sparsely populated, even by Alaska standards, with small, isolated communities, and a large portion of the territories is treeless, too. So, like Alaska, there's no one solution that will fit all the needs. They have to get creative, Prieto says, and policies have to be flexible. It's worth the investment, though, because of the potential long-term economic benefits.
If you have wood resources, you have local employment, you have local development. But much more important than that is the capacity. In some communities, especially in northern Ontario, they are at the capacity, near the capacity of their diesel generation. When they reach 75% of capacity, they go into a load restriction status. Any local industry is told you have to cut back on your power consumption.
And that's not an attractive situation for industries exploring new locations. Blair Hogan of the Teslin-Tlingit Council in the Yukon also spoke. While they have hydro for their electric needs, they were on diesel for heat. He says their new biomass heat system uses chipped waste wood harvested locally. How did policy help them? Hogan says government grants were a major contributor, and with the new system, the community now has a source of local jobs and a way to reduce the area's wildfire risk. Ryan Hennessy is senior energy planner with the provincial government of Yukon. He says the government has a basket of policies to increase the viability of biomass. One example is a policy to use biomass in public facilities and government buildings. That provides a large, steady customer for wood chips and pellets, thus supporting the industry.
What went along with the biomass energy strategy was public consultation, and this proved very important to us. We heard a lot of things both for and against biomass. People were broadly in favor of biomass energy.
But he says people also had concerns about the potential for overharvesting and environmental problems related to emissions. So Hennessy says they worked to calm concerns about timber supply and emissions. The newest technology provides a pretty clean burn. And they helped fund training within communities such as Teslin, teaching locals the various aspects of supplying and running a chip boiler. Washington and Oregon also have some established policies to encourage biomass. Dylan Cruz of Portland-based Sustainable Northwest says one of the challenges for biomass is, right now, it's more expensive than natural gas. But, he says, policies can narrow that price gap through tax credits like those that drive solar and wind energy projects. That would require people in the biomass industry to toot their own horns.
We don't do it as well, we're not as proud of it, but we should be. It's renewable. It's baseload power. That's very valuable to utilities. It's got diverse outputs and distribution, whether it's electricity or heat or even transportation fuels. It can save money, it can reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, and it has a lot of other great ancillary benefits like supporting forest stewardship and controlled waste disposal.
There are some federal programs in place that help, such as the U.S. Forest Service's wood energy grants, but Cruz predicts there will be less help on the federal side in coming years. So the focus should be on increasing and improving policies within individual states. Cruz says the best way to encourage state policy is to talk with lawmakers and their staff, and to work with individual communities that are interested in biomass so they too can lobby for state incentive policies. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And I'm Angela Denning. This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. Thanks for listening.